I'm going to have to talk in a normal voice. Yeah. A little bit louder than normal, I think.
Yes, because, you know, from your diaphragm as though we are recording important information.
Yes. Hello and welcome to episode 117 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, today joined by Seth Miller.
And joined in your hometown.
Yeah, we're in Portland.
It's crazy.
We're at the Hyatt House.
It's not the Riot House.
Not the Riot House?
Not the Riot House.
Oh, okay. It's a nice hotel, though. It's
actually really nice. You're saying it's brand new, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much just opened, like, I think a few weeks ago.
So it's entirely possible, like, I'm the first person in this room?
Probably. I mean, we calculated, about 200 rooms?
Yeah.
So it's a decent-sized hotel.
Yeah, really nice. It's my first time in a Hyatt House anywhere.
Yeah, I've never been in one either.
It feels a lot like a studio apartment.
It's about the size of a studio apartment.
It'd be a big studio in New York, but sure, we'll go with that. seriously. You know, it's a collection of, like, goods and supplies and sundries, dishwasher, full sets of dishes, and, like, a frying pan and stuff to cook.
Yeah.
There's a little range top.
A little bit of everything.
There's a small coffee maker. You can get a big coffee maker if you ask downstairs.
Didn't they have, like, a list of games that you could get?
Yeah. Beats headphones.
Hey, that's important for some people to listen to their music.
I'm considering asking for a pair just to, like, see what they're like, except then I'd be the guy that had Beats headphones, and I'm not sure how I feel about that.
I think you should ride your bike tomorrow with Beats headphones on.
Ride the Portland
Bike Town Bomb bikes. Yeah.
You think they'll fit over my helmet that I traveled here with?
I think you'd have to put them underneath.
Hampus, that plastic headband thing, I don't know if the helmet would fit.
You just have to deal with it.
I'm going to err on the side of helmet over these headphones, but thank you for the suggestion. I appreciate that.
I'm watching out for you.
I'm not entirely sure that's true.
So this episode, I actually forgot the date. Well, it'll air, even though you wrote it on my notes.
Yeah, I gave it to you, and you still didn't say it.
Totally spaced. Okay. This will air on September 1st, so if you're listening...
It's probably September 1st.
Probably September 1st. And you probably already knew that, because you know what date it is.
Do you ever know what day it is?
I don't know what day it is. I know what date it is.
Interesting.
For the most part.
Okay.
Sometimes.
Yeah, I feel like my work schedule doesn't lend myself to knowing or caring about either the day or the date.
So you don't care what day of the week it is?
Very little.
Yeah. Your Monday is like your Saturday.
Depends on the week.
Yeah. It's true. So for our dot, we have LAX. We talked about LAX a lot in the last few shows.
I'm sorry. They did more new strange things.
That's true. I mean, they're getting new gates.
Well, so this is an interesting... We'll put a link in the show notes. Brett Snyder over at Cranky Flyer put together this sort of analysis. There's been back and forth between the local neighborhoods surrounding LAX and the airport authority itself, and lawsuits, and I don't know. His analysis of it is very, very good and definitely worth reading. But he basically, the short version seems to be that somehow the airport authority has managed to convince the local neighborhoods to stop suing them. And, like, in exchange for a park.
Hey, easy to please.
It turns out. and, like, the old deal was reduction of gates and no new growth and all these things. And the new deal is, like, forget all that. We're actually going to operate like a real business. And sucks for those of you who live in, is it Westchester is the neighborhood?
Westchester.
Just north of the airport.
Westchester County, right? Or is that Westchester County? Or is
well, that's in New York.
The town of Westchester.
The town of Westchester. Just north of the airport. Yep. Yeah. And so, like, it was this whole thing where the 380, the two parallel runways on the north side are too close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 380s, when they land there, create havoc with taxiways and things like that. And apparently these local neighborhoods had successfully sued to stop construction of additional taxiways.
Yeah, because they wanted to put a taxiway in between the two runways, right? And move the runway out further.
So they were going
to
move the runway out further and put the taxiway in between. That is still not going to happen.
Okay.
Unless the FAA mandates that there needs to be a central taxiway. And if the FAA mandates it, this neighborhood group has agreed to not sue about that when the time comes. So if I'm LA right now, I'm lobbying the FAA like crazy.
Like, please. Please
demand this of us. Pretty please. Look how dangerous this is. We're awful. You should come make us be better.
Because it would speed things up. Because right now, like when you high-speed taxi off of 24 right, I think that is the far north runway, you basically have two exits. There's two places you can exit.
Yeah.
And it puts you right onto 24 left almost. And creates...
part of the problem is like the mid-runway exit is way too close to... or is way too short for landing. And so you're moving too fast when you take it was apparently one of the problems. So they're going to move that one further down.
Okay.
So that'll help a little bit.
Okay.
But they're also just going to extend like the taxiway I guess, inside of 24 left, closer to the terminals.
Okay.
It doesn't go all the way to the end anymore. And so, like, apparently, they, like, part of it was a back taxi somewhere on a runway or something. The layout was not built for as many large planes as they get. Like, every other airport, you know, in the United States that's been around for more than a year and a half.
But they have space to work with.
A little bit.
A little bit.
There's a highway just on the north edge.
Yep. And then the ocean.
There's an ocean there. That would be much harder to extend into. And I feel like, isn't on, like, the south edge, there's, like, the gas tanks and stuff?
There's a oil field thing, like, where they hold, like, gas storage.
Yeah.
Like, storage tanks.
So there, it is, I mean, and on the south side, it's blocked in by the buildings of, what's the town there?
That's not Santa Monica, that's...
No, Santa Monica's to the beach side. There's, like, I don't remember the name now.
But yeah, it's, like, it's
there's
closed.
There's a town
now.
Right there.
Yeah.
Just with a bunch of reasonable size office buildings and some neighborhoods and stuff like that. So it is relatively boxed in. I think they can move a little north towards Westchester. It's the only side that they can really grow on. And they might be forced to do so by the FAA. And apparently the cities or the neighborhoods have agreed to let that go. There's also talk of moving some of the gates around and letting them grow back into some of the stuff that they'd cut.
Because they gave up 10 gates, right? As part of
something like that. The American Eagle bus gates are going to come back to the terminal, maybe. It's going to be, you know, all sorts of good news.
Southwest might get an extra little finger.
T-Zero.
Right? Yeah, T-Zero.
Is what Brett called it. Yeah, like, possibility of sort of building back out a new terminal. Lord knows Southwest wants that, right?
They have a ton of flights out of L.A. And
yeah, and their facilities are terrible.
Yeah. And I think they were talking about maybe putting the low-cost carriers on the far south side next to United and T9.
Yeah. Right.
But it would be connected to the rest of the terminals,
like
the others. So it wouldn't be the remote terminal, but it would be similar to it.
It would still be, you know, walkable. But they would think they were saying, like, what his analysis was, like, Hawaiian, JetBlue, maybe Virgin America would move over there, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Delta's going to move to T2, T3.
Yep.
Leaving 5 and half of 6. American moves from its piece of 6 up to 5, where Delta was. Alaska can have a little more room on 6. United's little 7-8 play.
Since we don't really know what Alaska's going to do at T6, like, are they going to grow LA with the merger, or, you know, that's...
I think they want to. I guess the Virgin stuff would no longer move to T9 because they're going to be just part of Alaska at that point. So they'll just go to 6. But, yeah, it's... I don't know. To me, the newsy part of this is just that, like, apparently the neighborhoods gave up. They seem to be in a very strong position, and they have given up. So I don't know. On the flip side, Santa Monica has announced they're going to close their airport.
Well, I don't agree with that, but, like, I don't agree with that decision.
I was going to say, you don't get a vote, Stephen. It's just the news.
No, I just think it's, I mean, I've driven by Santa Monica Airport a few times. I've stopped and watched planes come and go, little, you know, private planes come and go. It's a neat little airport, and it's something that private airports and private aviation has kind of been, I don't know how to put it, shoved to the back.
Yeah, put it bluntly. Tell us how you really feel.
I think that private aviation has always gotten, like, this bad rap. Like, people don't want private airports near their homes, and private aviation helps build commercial aviation over time, right? It fosters interest in aviation, and with a shortage of pilots, it's kind of important to foster an interest in aviation at this point.
Yeah, I see your point there. Making, like, kids happy to see the little planes coming and going while they watch.
And flight schools.
And flight schools. It's really expensive.
It is.
To get a pilot's license.
Yep.
So you can be as interested as you want, but putting up 120 to 150 grand to get a job working for 20 to 25 per year to start, it's not necessarily the smartest decision one can make. But
no, but I think that, like, by saying, but closing private airports doesn't help.
I'll give you that. I guess the other part of it that you have to wonder, that I have to wonder, is, like, what's the volume of traffic they're getting, and can it be supported with other nearby private strips? Like, at some point, is the airport costing them money to run and operate? They can only charge so much for landing fees and rent to whoever's got an FBO there, so.
Well, I mean, you got to think about where it's at. I mean, it's Santa Monica. I mean, it's a lot of, like, stars. I mean, that's where Harrison Ford flew out of, right?
Okay.
I think that's where his crash was at Santa Monica Airport. Wasn't it? Or was that Van Nuys? I don't remember. I'm going to look it up now, since we don't have the producer with us here in Portland. He didn't make the trip out with you.
Did not make the trip. I don't know. I get it, and, like, believe me, I like more opportunities or places to fly and things like that, but at some level I feel like even private aviation benefits from consolidating a little bit and having some infrastructure.
Yeah.
And you know, Santa Monica Airport, very close to LAX. There's going to be airspace conflicts. Maybe I'm biased by my New York City airspace conflict problems and, like, how when someone sneezes, the whole neighborhood goes to shit. But it's that level of, you know, could they do a good enough job by, you know, and it's not Long Beach, because although they do get some private down there, and that's part too, maybe that's too far south, but maybe it's, you shift everything to Van Nuys, but that's on the other side of town. I don't know the LA.
It was
at Santa Monica?
At Santa Monica. That's where he crashed.
Okay.
I mean, it's a small airfield. I'm not even sure they may not even have an FBO. I'd have to look it up. They may just have someone who operates like a fuel pump, yeah, and that's all they do. But
I mean, they're still like the hang. So then, you know, so you've got a couple hangars where Harrison Ford keeps his planes.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you've got to pay to maintain that facility and all those other things, like, does cost.
But I think the main argument, though, against Santa Monica Airport is that people are like, oh, it's too close to our houses.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't like the noise. And I don't know. That airport's been there a long time before you bought your house. So.
And the planes are quieter now, and there may be more of them, so that's, you know, win some, lose some. But
yeah, I mean, it is close. I'm looking at a map now. It is pretty close to LAX. I mean, it's separated by, it's El Segundo, that's south of LAX.
Thank you.
It's separated by the Marina del Rey area, okay, from LAX, so it's got probably, you know, 10 miles of separation. So
okay, so probably not really interfering with too much.
It probably wouldn't.
Flow.
If it's going to interfere with anybody, it'd probably be, and yeah, well, I don't think it would. The thing is, there's not a lot of municipal airports in Los Angeles to begin with. I mean, you can go up to Simi Valley in that area, and there's probably one up there. There might be something up north.
Yeah.
But you're talking, it's the only municipal airport.
On the south side.
On the south side.
Okay.
So.
Well, then I'm back on your side. What a bunch of morons.
Well, I think it's an interesting, I think everyone has their opinion. I'm sure if we had someone from Santa Monica on the show, they would probably give us good reasons on why they don't want it. And, like anything, it's political.
Want to be on the show?
Do you live in Santa Monica?
Do you live in Santa Monica and hate the airport? Give us a call.
We need a dial-in number. That's what we need.
Well, it would be a little awkward because people just call us when they're listening. You want them randomly calling you in the middle of the night?
No, I don't. we made the line Auckland to Everywhere. And you said I could change it. You said I could change it, but I actually kind
of
like it because it's the premium economy changes on Air New Zealand.
Yep.
They've announced, hey, we're getting rid of this seat. Space seat. It doesn't mean they're getting rid of premium economy altogether.
No, they're switching. So they're 77W. 77W had the space seat.
I think so, yeah.
And they're getting rid of it there and switching it to 772 ERs. Which is what I'm remembering now from my trip. That's what they fly on the Houston route.
Yep.
It's a stock product. It's traditional 242 across on a 777. Very, very standard. There's, I want to say nothing special about it except that premium economy beats the shit out of economy.
Yep.
Which is 343 for them. It's 10 abreast.
No matter which plane you're on.
On all of their 777s. Yep. So last December when I went down for the Houston inaugural, I flew out on the 77W via LA and back on the 772 via Houston and actually got to try both of them 3 or 4 days apart.
Okay.
I like the stock product better. That may not be an incredibly popular opinion, but I'm also not particularly wide. I'm taller than I am wide, mm-hmm, if you will. So legroom matters to me more than seat width. And the space seat had like the sort of weird curved pairs.
But they're not really facing each other, right? They kind of
you weren't facing each other. You faced away from each other. I guess the center pair definitely both faced out. The sides sort of faced both forward, but kind of staggered.
Okay.
So in that context, this goes back to a long-standing complaint I have about all the products of you can't really fly with someone. I guess if you had the center pair and sort of crane your neck around, you have a nice table in between you.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of space side to side, but front to back, even in that seat, I felt like trying to get comfortable and like sort of slouch down and recline it, whatever. I felt like my knees were kicking the seat in front of me.
That tight.
And maybe I was doing it wrong. I don't know.
That sounds tight. I mean, it sounds like it's not a lot of legroom.
It didn't feel like a lot of legroom. And the 772 product felt like more legroom to me. It was definitely not as wide because it's 242 instead of 222. But for my needs, and if you're flying with someone, you could sit next to them and actually, you know, engaged. I ended up sitting next to just a random Air New Zealand executive on the return flight, and we had great conversations because we were sitting next to each other.
Do you think the other impetus for this is they can fit two more people per row in premium economy?
I'm sure there's a density thing going on where they're going to get more seats on board. I haven't looked at the numbers, but I have to assume that that's part of it.
Yeah.
I also would kind of, I mean, cost a lot of money to replace the seats, but at some point they were getting to be a little long in the tooth anyways, and it was time probably for a refresh.
So they're just going to rotate them through.
Going with a stock product means it's a little less expensive, and spare parts and all those other things are sort of available everywhere, right? If, when you're using the same product that XYZ other airlines were all using, with a different fabric cover on it or whatnot, like...
You can still make do when something goes wrong.
When something goes wrong, you can get widgets and sprockets all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes
without
sense.
Without having to necessarily stock all your own inventory.
That makes a lot of sense,
much
actually.
Of your own. So, there's a lot of reasons to go that way, and right, the bad part about it is 242 means middle seats.
Yeah, two middle seats.
There's two middle seats on the row, and you know we've certainly talked that to death with business class and United, and a few other airlines that also do similar, but United. So, you know, it's not great, but... Everyone sort of does it in premium economy, so I don't think... You know, they're losing, but they're not really losing. They're downgrading, but they're not losing with that change, I feel.
Yeah,
like.
I get that. Yeah. So do you think, then, the offering is still good enough? Like, did you look at Coach on Air New Zealand?
Yes, it's 10 abreast.
And that's the selling point right there for you, like that premium economy is worth it. And
how much?
Yeah.
I'll never say, yes, it's absolutely worth it. I got to see a price point. But...
For a 15-hour flight.
It's a long trip.
Yep. And, I mean, that brings up a good question because Turkish is flying 777s, 77Ws.
Yep.
And they were getting rid of premium economy at one point. I haven't heard anything else about that. And I'm not sure it's actually been pulled off.
At this point, they're such a cluster fudge of
who knows what's going on.
Other than we definitely know that they're supporting the government.
Yes, it's very clear.
It's very clear. They put on the IFE screens now, too. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see that.
Like the statement of the support for the Prime Minister on the IFE screens as well.
I actually have someone who flew them. I know someone who flew them yesterday.
Yeah.
And they were in Istanbul today. And they said everything was fine. I mean, there was another attack not in Istanbul, but in Turkey.
Oh, yeah.
It was a bombing at a police station. So
missed that one.
But they said you know everything was fine at the lounge. It was weird to call or to hear about the news and then like see the sign for the entrance to the lounge is not what they thought it was. What was it called? It's the
July 15th lounge.
Yes, the July 15th.
The Patriots of July 15th or something like that.
Yeah. I'll have to ask her if she has a picture of that.
Yeah, did they actually like put up signage for that?
I think so.
Oh, God.
Because
they're losing money hand over fist because people aren't going to Turkey and aren't connecting through Istanbul nearly as much.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Oops. But yeah, we can invest in excellent new signage at our airports.
The destination's Iceland. We wanted to talk about Iceland because we talked about the Faroe Islands a little bit.
Yeah.
But you visited Iceland in the same trip.
Same trip. We spent a lot more time in Iceland. It's bigger.
And you actually did something kind of cool. You rented an RV-type vehicle. It's not an RV.
I rented a recreational vehicle and drive state to state.
Yes. You rented a van.
It's a van. It's a minivan of sorts.
Yeah.
Dacia Dasher or something like that. I don't know. But it's essentially like a minivan or delivery van with the back ripped out.
Oh, okay. With like a little bed and...
Yeah, so it's like a little like foam mattress, foam pad, and you put sleeping bags on top of that. And they sort of built in a shelving system in the back. So there's like bins and stuff to hold plates and glassware and, you know, a little camping stove you buy gas tanks for.
Levels, man.
Yeah. No, you definitely build vertically. And so when you're sleeping, you slide your feet under that.
Yeah.
It worked out surprisingly well. It's a lot of time. I mean, we spent a week in it. 6 nights. So that's a lot of time in this very small space. And like all of our time, like we were either out hiking
or
in the car.
Yeah.
In the van. So like the first, and it was tough. The first night it was a little drizzly. And so we were in the car, even at the campsite. The rest of the time, you know, we had camping chairs and whatnot that we rented through them. And so, like, you put up a chair, you got the grill running.
And then the only time you're spending out inside the van,
you're driving or sleeping.
Yeah.
And you know, you put your feet up and whatnot. You know, like, you know, camping chairs and table and a grill. And
yeah,
they gave us a pretty good chef's knife and a cutting board. And you know, we had some. It was fun. We went in one of the towns. We went and got langoustines. So one of the fishery areas is famous for the langoustines, like mini lobsters, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they were delicious, but it was stupid expensive. I mean, everything there is expensive, and this added another layer to that. I want to say we got two appetizers and shared the jumbo main course, but the jumbo main course was like $80.
Dude!
Yeah. And beer, you know, the beer to go with it, which would make me think less about it, the fact that I paid $80 for dinner, or, you know, for the main course, was $10 to $12 for whatever pint of beer. So,
sheesh.
So it was, you know, but it was a delicious meal. We had a good time. But the next night, or the next afternoon, we went to the grocery as we were driving through the town, whatever. So there's enough grocery stores sort of all around that you can find whatever you need along the way. And we're in the frozen section trying to decide what protein we were going to grill. And I found a bag of frozen langoustines. And so for like, and the big meal was like three tails and three claws or something like that. It was good, but it was a normal sized, you know, I say big. It was a normal sized one person's entree that we then augmented with some appetizers and made work. We bought 10 tails because that's what the size of the frozen was. And that was like $40 maybe.
So like half the price.
Half the price for three times as much food. And took them out, bought a block of butter. The smallest you could buy was a half kilo, so it's a pound of butter. And we tried to find, like, I was like, can I steal pats of butter from the restaurants and make up for it? No.
They charge for those too, like $4.
They just couldn't get enough. Just couldn't get enough of them to come out. I did take one from the place the night before, but then we needed way more than just a little pat of butter. Got a head of garlic and some chives or something like that, because the vegetables we could find, like some herbs, and made an herbed garlic butter and melted it and went buckle. I just took the langoustines, chopped them in half lengthwise, put them on the grill, drowned them in butter. It was the most decadent meal of the trip. And we were just sitting there with our fingers, like, gluttonous as could be. It was amazing.
Did you have a fridge? Could you keep things cool? Or did you have, like, a cooler?
We had a cooler.
So you had to keep a cooler with ice and stuff to keep everything.
And the woman, when we picked it up, was like, oh, do you want some of these, like, freezer packs? Like, you know, like the blue, whatever. And I'm like, I don't think that's going to work, because after the first night, they're just going to be
melted.
Packs. And she's like, no, they'll be good. And so we had to schlep those around. Like, not that it matters, but they took up space in the cooler.
Yeah.
I guess we could have put them elsewhere in the van. There's plenty of space in the van. There's often more than sleeping. That's the other thing. You move your suitcases to the front seat when you're asleep.
Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, what about showers and showering?
So, it's interesting. There's a very good infrastructure of campsites around the country.
Okay.
We drove the full ring road, Route 1, that sort of, you know, does the full circle. On the east side, it sort of cuts through the middle a little bit. There is another road that stays way up on the coast. We didn't have enough time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But, so we did the full route, and people do it all the time. We did it in 6 nights, which was very aggressive. 8 to 10 would be more normal.
Preferred,
I would probably say. I mean, putting aside the fact that it means that much more time sleeping in a van, I would say 10 to 12.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's gorgeous hiking to be done. There's a ton to see and do. We missed chunks of the country. We didn't do the far northeast. We didn't do the far northwest. There would have been some nice day trip drives up through some of the fjord areas that just would have been really nice to have been able to do. So I could easily go back and like do the same trip again and skip some things.
See new things.
You know, stop, you know. Basically, we like skipped every other stop. We did like the even stops on the loop, and next time we do the odd stops sort of going around. So there's definitely more to see. But it was
the showers.
The showers, sorry. Yeah.
So the infrastructure.
So the camping infrastructure is really, really good.
Yeah.
And for, depending on the campground, $10 to $15 per car or per person. So
depending on
what it is and where and how, you get access to their facilities. And so campgrounds are essentially a grass field somewhere relatively close to other sites on the main highway.
Yeah.
And there's usually hookups for electricity and things like that if you've got a big RV. There's waste dump sites and all that stuff. You pay more for those sorts of things. If you're just in a car, like we were, you pull in and you've got access to their kitchen. It's like a dorm kitchen or something like that.
That everyone can use.
Yeah, communal, whatever. We didn't use those as much because it's a grill space, grills and stuff, not usually ovens or anything like that. But we had a gas, little camp stove that we had a gas tank for, and we had a barbecue charcoal grill that we got from the rental company. So we made do just cooking out on our own, but somewhere you can go wash the dishes, full toilets, usually hot showers, depending on, some of them had laundry, some was DIY laundry, some was the person working the front counter did the laundry overnight while you slept, or did it tomorrow because you're staying for 3 or 4 nights, not a different campground every night like we did. But yeah, the infrastructure supports it really well.
And you found enough of these where you could do a 10 or 12 day trip.
Oh, yeah.
With a carry-on bag, basically, because you have someone to do your laundry if you run out of clothes or...
Yeah, and also it was camping, so I basically just was dirty the whole time.
Yeah, everyone kind of expects it, and you just want to get clean the last day before you get on your plane.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure my wife appreciated it, but what the heck.
She just had to sleep next to you.
Yeah, well, separate sleeping bags, so it's cool. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Talking with her, she says maybe next time a tent in addition to the van.
Yeah, so
sometimes
it's nice
to sleep on nice nights, you can sleep outside a little bit more. But yeah, it was really, really.
How crowded was the road?
It got crowded at times. We were there end of June, early July. So that's peak season.
High season.
That's one of the reasons we went to camper van. I don't think we could afford the hotels.
Yeah.
The last night in town, we used Cub Carlson points at one of the Rasmus Blues. And that was vaguely affordable. But it was definitely peak season, mostly French.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of French.
Interesting.
Some of them actually brought their own vehicles over.
They shipped them?
Yeah, come across on a ferry or something.
That's crazy.
We saw French license plates.
That's kind of awesome, though.
I know you remember this. The accident we saw where I thought someone died, which it turns out, at least at the time, they didn't. But they got medevaced back to Reykjavik to go to the hospital. Was a French, Land Cruiser or something like that.
Interesting.
Old school, big, high center of gravity camper.
Yeah.
Huge sort of Land Rover type vehicle, but with a rack on the roof and everything. And when we came around the corner and saw it, the rack was in three pieces in the middle of the road. The car was upside down, badly damaged on the side of the road.
Was it a single car accident? Or did it hit
somebody? Yeah, no, single car.
Wow.
Yes, and the roads, especially on the east side of the island, are just wide enough and not a lot of shoulder. So, I saw some skid marks as well. And when we went back through the second, when we saw it, couldn't get any cell phone reception. So, drove back around the corner to a house that I'd seen a mile up the road.
Yeah.
And asked the woman, because I saw kids playing outside, so I knew there was someone home. Went inside and said, please call whoever you call for emergencies. There's been a terrible trouble crash around the corner. And it was probably 3 or 4 miles, but we got there, whatever. And so by the time we got back, the emergency was on the way. Like, she put me on the phone to talk to the guy to explain what I saw. But at least that way I knew there was cell phone reception or a landline.
Yeah.
And there was someone home because I saw the kids. So, but that car, it was not good. But we saw the skid marks. It looks like their tire, the right side went off the road. They went to recover, overcorrected, went back and forth, and then eventually rolled it.
Wow.
So, and it didn't look like they, tumbled, but they definitely rolled the car. I mean, it was upside down when we got there. So, it definitely rolled, but the skid marks didn't look good.
That's
so
crazy.
Yeah, that was nuts, though. Drive the speed limit.
Yeah,
absolutely. Pay attention.
Yeah, pay attention. Stay on the road.
Yeah.
That takes a little mistake and you're...
That was one of the reasons I was happy to be in a smaller car.
Yeah, absolutely. Easier to keep between the lines and...
Yeah.
Was it, now they had options. I looked online for for the thing. They had options for bigger vehicles.
Yep.
And they had automatics, which is kind of rare for Europe. I mean, to get something that is
you pay double for that.
Yeah, exactly. So if you drive a standard.
I felt pretty good about it. I was telling you in the car earlier, when it has one of those auto restart engines, cause it was a relatively new model. So the once or twice I stalled, just popped the clutch and brake. And again, the car's running. It was great. and they drive on the right side of the road, like the U.S.
The correct side.
A week later, I was driving in a manual in England on the left side of the road and also didn't crash that one. So I'm pretty proud of myself.
That's impressive.
For a guy who doesn't drive and only learned to drive manual when I was around 20, to be able to do it alternating sides within a week of each other and not destroy anything.
It's a little impressive, especially since you live in New York and you don't drive on a daily basis.
No, I probably drive fewer than 20 days a year.
That is impressive. So the whole country, though, I mean, you could spend...
Full insurance. Definitely get full insurance.
Get the full insurance. Just in case.
Because you might run into me on the road.
Yeah. So the country, though, it looks amazing. Your pictures look amazing.
Some of the
most
beautiful scenery. Rival South Island of New Zealand.
Just breathtaking. Stop the car. Get out.
We very much had a theory of a schedule, at least for the first couple days. We wanted to make sure we didn't get stuck.
Yeah.
Right, and find ourselves day three having gone a tenth of the way.
Yeah.
So we sort of put ourselves on, I know we can't stop every time, and then you pull around a corner and be like, okay, that's a waterfall we have to go see. So, and there were a few I'm super glad we did. There was one that we sort of went off the path a little bit. Like, there, you can see where they're closing the extra part of the path that we ended up hiking on. We did it anyways, and you got up sort of behind the falls and got this amazing rainbow over the waterfall kind of scene. Some things like that. There was one where we kept hiking up and up and up, like, I wonder what's up around this curve. I wonder what's around this curve. And, like, finally we were like, there's definitely a path here somewhere, but it's starting to peter out. Maybe we should turn around and go back. And it's been an hour kind of thing. So definitely some interesting things like that. The weather, this doesn't always cooperate on the north.
Just random rains? Or
yeah, the north. The one day we were going to see the largest waterfall. So when you do it, there's the, called the Golden Circle Tour. So if you just go to Reykjavik,
yeah,
you'll go to Tingvellir, which is where the thing was. That was the original Icelandic government, the Viking government site.
Yep.
Which is now basically a big grassy field, but it's got a little waterfall and you can walk around and it's kind of cool. It's also where the tectonic plates are splitting.
Oh.
So you actually see the fracture between Europe
and America. Where the North American and European plates meet.
And it's, and well, they're splitting. So it's like these two massive rocks and the gap between them keeps getting bigger.
Isn't there a pool too you can go in and actually swim in the trench? I can't remember if it's in Iceland or if it's somewhere else. I think it might be. I'll have to look it up later.
There may be something like that in Iceland. We didn't go swimming. It was a little chilly that evening. Although the thermal pools, that's the other thing. It's like you wake up in the morning or, you know, after a day of hiking, you go soak in a thermal pool for a couple hours.
Yeah.
Very revitalizing. Very, very nice. Super hot. But
so, good,
but
good way to spend the evening, basically.
It is. It is. So, but no, so, but don't do the Blue Lagoon unless it's the only choice you have on a layover.
That's what I've heard. Everybody's
the Blue Lagoon is huge and massive and kind of disgusting. Not like dirty or anything. It's just like it's crowded and kitschy and wants to be a resort and wants to be a spa and all these things. And to me, the other places we went and did, like, the random hot springs were way more fun. And we did a couple paid ones. There's some just generic, like, swimming pools, swimming holes that also exist that are fed by hot springs.
Yeah.
There's a free one on the south shore that's supposed to be really, really cool. I don't know why we didn't choose that one, but we did. So.
But, I mean, there's so many that you could go. Yeah. You could go back and go to a new one, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. So it... But yeah, that experience was spectacular, just soaking in that. I don't know if the minerals and whatnot are actually healthy and made me feel better, but...
It's refreshing.
It was
a nice, great, relaxing thing. Yeah, so, I mean, it makes sense.
Also, that covers your shower for the day.
If the audience can't see, I'm scratching my chin.
Yeah, you're impressed by that, like, combination of efficiency, right?
I am. The one thing that I'm really interested in is the hiking. So it sounds like really driving the ring road and getting a camper is probably the way to go because you could just pull over.
I mean, you definitely need a car, and there are places to stay out and about if you wanted to do that. Iceland Air at one point owned all the hotels. I don't know if they still do, but there's a chain that circles the island, and it's roughly the same spacing as where we camped. But in some cases, the campground is the grass field next to the hotel. Pay at reception kind of thing. So it's, and those you actually get full hotel services. So like if the hotel has a pool or whatever, you can just, or the Wi-Fi in the hotel, you can use that.
That's kind of awesome.
Sit in the lobby kind of thing.
I mean, it really, I think it opens up a new way of traveling for people in Iceland. Cause I think everybody assumed, oh, I got to stay in these expensive hotels or hostels or someone's, you know, I got to Airbnb it if that exists there.
It does. There's not a ton of,
but it's expensive properties too, right?
Yeah. We didn't look at a ton of much. I don't know what the prices were in town in Reykjavik. There's actually a lot of options. Once you get out of Reykjavik, options fall apart very quickly. It's
a tiny country.
330,000 people, 250,000 of which live in Reykjavik.
Yeah.
And so the other 80,000 are spread around the rest of the country.
And it's desolate and there's not a lot going on.
But, you know, you go kayaking among the icebergs and then a couple hours later, you're hiking down to the Black Sand Beach to the Navy DC-3.
Yeah.
Which was very cool.
Did you drive the camper down to it?
You can't drive down to it anymore. It's like 4 kilometers each way.
Ooh.
It's like in a field, and some people say it was a farm. I don't know that you could grow anything in that, but sure. But
it's like black rock, right?
Yeah, it's black rock. But it was a well-marked pathway. It was obvious where you're supposed to drive, and apparently people were just driving off-road anyways, and so the farmer's like, screw this, and locked the gate.
No, well,
so you can still walk.
Yeah.
But, and it's, you could, I don't know, it was like... People are assholes.
People are idiots.
But you could walk out there still and, like, climb around on the plane. There was someone skateboarding on top of it while I was there, which was strange.
I have no words.
Yeah.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah. We can talk about this as long as you want. I mean, we can do it another episode later. I mean, there's so much to talk about from there.
And I'm sure our listeners probably have questions too. Yeah. So it might be good, you know, if people have questions about camping and stuff, I think they should post them on Twitter or somewhere just so they can ask.
It's such an incredible place. Biggest challenge, tourism has taken off so much, it's getting crowded.
Just like everywhere you go, it's there's someone around.
In 2015, they had 150,000 visitors in July.
Half the population.
For a country of 330,000.
Yeah.
It's a massive influx.
That's a lot of people.
I didn't actually believe the numbers. My wife told me some of the numbers, like, yeah, they did blah, blah, blah per year. And I'm like, there's no way these are right. And looked it up, and of course she was right, because...
She did the research.
Yes, and she... It's smart enough not to say things like that unless she knows what she's talking about. But I was like, I was shocked at how many visitors it was.
It's the Portland of the North Atlantic.
Sure. I'll give you that.
I'm being sarcastic.
Okay.
I think we only have time for one more story because we're gonna go to dinner, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to eat here?
I would like to go get some dinner.
Yeah. You look hungry.
I do.
Would you rather talk about United or Delta? We always talk about United.
Let's talk about Delta.
Let's talk about Delta. Heathrow.
Heathrow.
They are.
It's an airport in England.
In London. Outside of London.
Outside of London.
Delta is switching up which terminal they're going to be using.
So they were split right now.
Yeah, that's what they're currently doing. They were kind of like the old United, where United was using, T2 and T7? Yeah, remember when back at the merger time.
Okay, yeah. At the merger time, well, Continental was in T4. I don't remember where United was.
Yeah, I don't either.
Probably T1?
Maybe, yeah.
T2, I don't know. So when Delta signed on with Virgin Atlantic, they... Originally, Delta was a T4 and Virgin Atlantic was T3. Delta moved some of their flights to T3, and it was, I know it was JFK, I think maybe LA, or some, I think Atlanta moved maybe. I've got the story somewhere right here. Whatever, they moved what I'll call the higher value flights, or the ones that operated, it was definitely the New York flights because they tried to make a shuttle service to match BA and AA. And they consolidated some, but not all of them. And so, obviously, inefficiencies operating like that. But it also meant that for the through passengers connecting from Delta to SkyTeam partners at Heathrow, they were all in the same terminal, which is T4.
Yeah.
Because T3 doesn't have SkyTeam.
It's a selling feature of Star Alliance, right? Everybody's in T2.
At Heathrow now, yeah. It's a huge thing for them there. I mean, even, you know, Oneworld, BA is too big and already, you know, it can't even fit in T5, so they do some out of T3. And then Americans at T3, Cathay is at T3. I think most of the other Oneworld partners are at T3. Yeah. Some were at T1 for a while, but that's now gone. So it's not bad. Obviously you want to be in the same terminal for these connections. And so the interesting thing here is Delta is basically choosing its 49% owned, I don't want to call it a subsidiary, but 49% owned partner as being more important, and they have a joint venture that covers all the U.S. to U.K. flights. So they're choosing that joint venture over the transatlantic joint venture with Alitalia, Air France, KLM. And I just, you know, I think it's a smart business decision. Obviously, if you can consolidate, not having to staff two sets of counters is good. Like, there's all sorts of reasons it's good. For the few passengers that are connecting through, it's bad. And then it raises the question, like, how many people were connecting through? Is Heathrow really this, like, crux of connection, you know, this linchpin of connecting whatever that it's made out to be? And obviously for BA it is, because that's their hub.
I mean, I would say the connections for Delta on Virgin Atlantic would probably be somewhere into Africa, into the Middle East, and maybe Russia. And that's
Virgin Atlantic doesn't fly to Russia.
They don't?
They tried to get the Moscow route, and EasyJet got it instead.
Okay, never mind. I'm thinking the Middle East and Africa flight.
There's a Dubai flight. I don't remember what they still have in Africa.
I mean, they were cutting. They still have Johannesburg, right?
Sorry, they do all the way to South Africa. I was thinking up the armpit.
Yeah, I'm thinking more like South Africa.
Yeah, so there are a couple of those, but Delta flies to Joburg. Yeah. Like, from Atlanta. I don't know, it's... The route map is such that I feel like... And I think Dubai is covered by the joint venture with Air France KLM. Yeah. So... And obviously they can put those connections across... They're going to put those connections across Paris or... Amsterdam.
And they have a ton of feed into both of those places.
Sure. So at some level, it just comes down to, like, actually Heathrow's not a connecting airport for SkyTeam. And Delta's acknowledging that and saying, okay, guys, but, like, we don't actually do this here.
And I would come close to arguing that Heathrow's not that for the Star Alliance much anymore either.
There are still a number of secondary German cities that are served by German wings you can do it for.
Yeah, that's about it.
Probably about it.
Yeah.
All of the fares allow for it, and there's enough different hubs for Star Alliance in Europe that, you know, if it's Austrian to Vienna or the Swiss cities, I feel like there's just enough that it sort of works there, but it's definitely not, it's more than SkyTeam, but it's not VA.
It comes down to like preference. It's like, oh, do I want to fly San Francisco, Chicago, Vienna, or do I want to fly San Francisco, Heathrow, Vienna?
Right.
That's really.
Yeah. And you actually have a choice as opposed to SkyTeam where
you don't really have one. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, it does sound like the right business decision.
I definitely think it's the right business decision. It's just, it's weird. It's a little, it's not weird. It's interesting to see how the different business models are evolving and how alliances matter, but not nearly as, I don't want to say not as much, but in certain scenarios are just not as significant as they used to be.
There's a business case for other things.
Yeah, and you look at some of the other operations, the joint ventures to Asia, AAJAL or United ANA,
yep.
Those are putting Delta out of business at Narita,
yep.
Arguably, right? So, and that's above and beyond just having an alliance, right? Obviously, Delta could route people through to all the Asian cities on Korean with their alliance partner,
yep.
But they're not joint venture partners, and it's not a good business partnership, so they don't. So it's showing, I feel like some of the alliance edges are starting to fracture.
That's true. I mean, I think we see that with all the alliances, but especially with Delta because of kind of the weakness of SkyTeam in certain places.
And this goes back to what we were talking about in the last episode about Vietnam Airways is now owned partly by ANA.
Yep.
And that's a Star Alliance with a 10% investment in a
SkyTeam
carrier. And where's the decision going to happen? So
yep.
Just more of the same, but it's going to be interesting to watch over the next couple of years, I think.
Same, same, but different. Well, I think that wraps up the show. We're going to go to dinner.
Yeah, you should too. I hope it's evening wherever you are.
You can follow Dots, Lines, and Destinations on Twitter at Dots, Lines. You can go to the website, leave us a comment, moredotsmorelines.com. Leave us an iTunes review. I think, you can find us on YouTube now too. So
sweet.
Listen to us wherever you want. Anyway, happy travels.
Take care.